Welcome to Role Playing History, the podcast where we explore the history of role playing games. I'm Wayne Davis, and I'll be your guide for today's tour. Episode 52, our 1 year anniversary. I've been hyping this week's episode as the end of our first year of the show for several weeks now, and I gotta admit, it's a pretty damn big deal for me. Over the past 51 episodes, we've covered the gamut of gaming history, and I'd like to think we've learned some new things about things we already thought we knew everything about. Something else we've done over the past year is pick up listeners all over the world. As I record this episode, the top five countries we're heard in, other than the U.S., which is obviously number one. I mean, I am a U.S. citizen producing my shows in the American Midwest, so it makes sense. Anyway, our top five countries are Canada, Finland, the United Kingdom, Spain, and Australia. I also know we've got some folks in Asia listening, as well as a listener or two in South America and in Africa, so we've made some worldwide headway over the past year. We've also developed some really great relationships with others in the business, including Gamer Mom Luna, who was the first person to have us on her show, which we did back in January, by the way, Tales from the Tavern. I've also developed a really cool relationship with the crew at Awfully Queer Heroes to the point that I'm going to do a review of their new module as soon as I get it. I've already decided, actually, we're going to put that on the Bad GM's campaign build-along. Yeah, that's what it means to me. I've also got to do a shout-out to @BookMuse on Twitter because she was the first person to reach out to the show on Twitter, and we still communicate back and forth at least once a week. So much love to all of you. Above and beyond all of that, each and every one of you have reached out to me in some way, shape, or form over the past year. You've provided your own feedback and your requests for the show, and I've tried my damnedest to make improvements as we've gone along. And of course, as I've mentioned, the success of this show spurred me on to create a production company to oversee not only this show, but to create an entirely new show to focus on the creation of your own campaign to run at home. I mentioned the name already. Let's say it again because I can't promote myself enough. That other show is Bad GM's Campaign Build Along. It is available wherever you get your podcasts. Now, for everything we've managed to accomplish here over the past year, I have to admit that there's one thing that drives me batshit, and it's the very first episode of this podcast. If you've never heard it, it's available in the archives, and you'll probably want to check it out at some point. My reasons for wanting to do a revisit, I was originally going to do a do-over, but we're going to do a revisit. There's a number of reasons, but the biggest reason why I feel we need to do a revisit is this. For all of the importance miniature wargaming has had in the creation of tabletop role-playing games, I didn't give it a whole lot of time in that very first show. Looking back on it, and I'm literally looking at the first episode because I pulled the script from my show archives to help with the show today, I think I was just trying to get through that first episode so I could get to the show that I really wanted to do, and that show was the reason why I created this podcast in the first place, and it was the history of Dungeons & Dragons. So in trying to speed through the history of games and gaming, I glossed over a number of subjects. Some of those subjects have either gotten their own show, like Dice, or they might get one in the future. Today, though, we're going to take a deeper look into the history of miniature wargaming because, in my opinion, if you understand miniature wargaming, you really understand where tabletop role-playing games came from. And to me, that's understanding your history. So, without further ado, let's get the bus cranked up and head off on today's subject, miniature wargaming. The history of wargaming as a whole goes back as far as there have been humans on Earth and, therefore, war on Earth. As noted in our very first episode, folks still play a game that many historians consider to be a war game, Go. Created nearly 2,500 years ago in China, the concepts of the game are to surround and control your opponent and either gain new territory or defend your own. That's it. And look, you can disagree with that theory if you want to, but at the end of the day, war games are pretty much about those concepts. I also named Couture and chess as predecessors to war games because their concepts were very similar as well. But insofar as really getting into the history of miniature wargaming, all right, well, this is going to be a deep dive of deep dives for us, and it starts in 1881. In 1881, the Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson was the first documented person to use toy soldiers in a war game. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean he was the first to do it, but without documentation to the contrary, we're going to give him that honor. The funny thing about Stevenson and his war games is that for all of the writing he did over the years, and he was a pretty prolific writer, the one thing he never published were his rules for wargaming. According to his stepson, the games Stevenson ran were very sophisticated and realistic, and he claimed they were on par with German military war games, which, for the record, were considered the creme de la creme at the time. One more note on Stevenson's game. They were played on the floor on a map he drew with chalk. So if Stevenson was the first person to use toy soldiers in his war game, why does H.G. Wells get so much credit for his book Little Wars? Well, as I mentioned way back in episode 1, Wells was the first person to actually publish their wargaming rules in a publication available to the masses. The book, 1913's Little Wars, laid out Wells' rules for wargaming, which didn't involve using dice or calculations to resolve fights. Instead, players would use spring-loaded cannons for artillery, and if pieces got knocked over from the cannons, they were lost and they were out. Insofar as infantry combat, it was only allowed to be hand-to-hand, and units suffered losses determined by their relative size. It should also be noted that Wells' version of a war game was meant to be played in a very large space like the lawn or a very large room inside. The reports I've seen on this subject have stated that the toy soldiers Wells used for his games would not fit on a tabletop very well. Wells' rules were regarded for a very long time as the standard by which other miniature war games were judged. However, it took a long time for the hobby to really take hold, and most historians believe it was two world wars that caused that. I mean, after all, playing war games isn't nearly as much fun when there's an actual world war going on that might end life as we know it. A little deep for this show, I'll grant you, but I think you get my point. So if you go back to that first episode, I mentioned a fellow by the name of Jack Scrubby, and I mentioned that he's considered to be by most the father of modern wargaming. I also listed several of his contributions to the game, including 54mm figures, the first ever figs moated in RTV rubber, and the Wargame Digest. Now, if you want to hear me expand on those accomplishments, you'll have to go back and listen to the episode, because I think I covered Mr. Scrubby pretty well, so I'm not going to repeat myself here. As the hobby got into the 1960s, more innovations were made in design, especially as it concerned the miniatures, as new sizes came into play, as did new methods for molding the figs, which made them easier to produce and therefore less expensive to purchase. In 1962, we've got the first report of what you'd call a big war game. Tom Bookwalter, Duke Seyfried, Gary Locker, Dave Towell, Dave Glazier, John Chandler, and others from the Dayton War Game Gang conducted the Battle of La Fere with about 8,000 figures on June 29th of that year. The timeline from here is the continuation of advancements in the methods and tactics for miniature wargaming, and so I'm going to jump away from the timeline and discuss other parts of the hobby. However, if you're interested in more timeline stuff about miniature wargaming, there's a really good timeline available online. I'll post a link to it on the post for this week's game, just above the follow us stuff I put there every week. It's a really good timeline, and I did borrow from it for today's show, so I got to give them credit. So we've done a bit of history of miniature wargaming, but I'll admit we could do an entire show just on the timeline of the hobby. So let's move on to discussing exactly how one goes about getting into the miniature wargaming hobby. And for the record, I am not a miniature wargamer. So much of the advice I'm giving here comes directly from the website of the Historical Miniatures Gaming Society, mixed with commentary from a number of other sources, and I'll point those out when I switch sources, if I remember to. Because I've been known to forget. Thanks for calling me out on that. I've seen lots of descriptions for what miniature wargaming is, but the HMGS says it better than I can, so I'm going to quote them directly from their website. Historical miniature wargaming is the recreation of historical battles, the tactical level of war, through the use of a 3D terrain table over which are deployed model forests, roads, rivers, and buildings, as well as miniature soldiers and vehicles depicting the actual participants of the engagement. Each miniature represents a certain number of historical soldiers or vehicles, as in the popular rules called Napoleon's Battles, where the ratio is one figure for every 100 historical combatants. The miniature forces involved are painted to depict the same color schemes or uniforms as were used by the historical combatants. In this regard, miniature wargaming departs from its sister wargaming wings, using cardboard or microchip and also being an art form as well as a competitive hobby. Yeah, that's a lot to digest. And I do have to repeat what I said in the quote, that non-historical miniature wargaming does differ from the historical games in several ways, but I'll dive deeper into that when I talk about Warhammer in a few minutes. When it comes to the battles themselves, every miniature wargame, whether it's historical or not, has some scenario or war or battle it's based on. For those doing historical minis, those battles can go all the way back to the empires of the Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans, and move all the way forward to modern day, as some historical miniature wargamers have taken up the battles of Vietnam and other combats and conflicts that have taken place since. If the game isn't historical, there's usually some created and provided background on why each side is involved in the conflict, and there tend to be some sort of stakes involved, such as the defending of territory against the expansion of a more aggressive attacker. Not that different from historical wargames, I'll grant you, but the units are usually quite different. One other difference that can occur between historical and non-historical miniature wargaming is the unit size. In a non-historical gaming session, games typically take place in one of two levels, skirmish or tactical. In the skirmish level, it's typically one warrior or equipment piece equal to one miniature, and the player controls those individual units. The tactical game is more like the historical game, where one miniature equals a set number of units, and the player controls groups of them in combat. Regardless of the type of miniature wargaming, the constant across them is the need for terrain and miniatures. Over the years, thanks to attendance at a number of conventions, as well as frequenting my local neighborhood game shops, I've had the occasion to see a whole lot of different setups for miniature games, and I can tell you this. Miniature wargamers take their terrain and miniatures seriously. Some gamers choose to build all of their terrain by hand. That means that when you look at the battlefield, every building, every tree, every rock is carefully crafted by hand. Some are carved from art-quality styrofoam, but many are also made from various woods and other materials. I've even seen some metals and plastics used for some pieces of terrain to give those items a more realistic feel. There are other gamers, however, that choose to not reinvent the wheel and instead turn to their local game shop or hobby shop to source the terrain pieces that they need. Thanks to miniature modelers and train enthusiasts, there have been a ton of advancements made over the years in the amount and quality of miniature terrain pieces, like trees, mountains, and such, that have made it to market. Of course, the wargamer has to take the scale they're using into consideration when building terrain, and the best place to start with that is the scale of the miniatures being used. Now, before I get further into this, I do need to note that Warhammer 40K doesn't have an official scale it conforms to, and that's because Games Workshop is the exclusive manufacturer of all official Warhammer 40K models. But if you're curious about scale, and I'm just the kind of geek who would be, let's take a quick look at scale. The largest miniatures that most wargamers would even consider playing with are 90 millimeters. That equates out to a scale of about 1 to 20. Next up, the 54mm figs, which are 1/33rd. After that, we've got 45mm, which is 1/40th, 28mm, which is 1/64th, 25.4mm, or 1 inch, which is 1/72nd, 25mm, which is 1/73rd, 20mm, which is 1/89th, 15mm, which is 1/120th, 6mm is 1/300th, and 2mm, which is 1/890th. So the figs can get pretty small, and that would come into play if you're looking to have a lot of units out on the field at one time. But that being said, it's important to know the size of the figures being used before you build your terrain, as you'll want to scale the terrain for the size of the figs. Otherwise, you could wind up with really big figs and small terrain, or the opposite with really big terrain and micro-sized minis. Taking all of that into account, what are we placing all this stuff on? I mean, are we just setting them on the table, or are we doing something different? Again, this is a matter not only of taste, but also the level of realism you're looking for in your game. I've seen miniature games laid out on folding banquet tables before, with nothing under the various pieces of terrain in the minis. Most of the time, those have been historical battles, because a number of historical battles do not use hexes or grids. Most of them use ratioed measurements to move pieces and therefore require a ruler. However, non-historical games typically use a grid of some type, and I've seen setups as basic as large sheets of paper with grids marked out on them, and features such as grass and water either colored in or painted in, and setups as complex as wooden bases with the grids laid in with stain or paint, and fake grass tacked or glued into place with depressions for the body of water carved into them, and painstakingly painted or actually filled in with liquid. With all the detail being put into the terrain, what about the miniatures themselves? How much attention do they tend to get? My answer to that depends on the individual gamer and or the group they belong to. Most miniature gamers want their minis painted, and most of them attempt to go with some sort of paint theme that runs through all their units. Now, obviously, if it's a historical game, the units will be painted with the colors of the uniforms that were worn by the particular army of the time, and care will be taken to be as historically accurate as possible. I realize that if you're doing a miniatures game based on, say, World War I, there will be a lot of green and tan out there. So how do you differentiate between the British and, say, the Americans? Believe it or not, there were enough differences in the two uniforms that if you take the time and have the patience, your miniatures will look different. Again, the various Warhammer games are a bit different, and again, I'll expand on that in a minute. When you look at the paints for these miniatures, the rule is this. If you can think of the color, it probably exists. I mean, the earliest miniature wargamers were able to take advantage of paints used by artists and commercial painters, since those were the folks who were buying paints at the time. Over the years, though, other hobbies, such as scale modelers and train enthusiasts, have created other types of paint that are more durable for miniature gaming, and their contributions to the hobby helped miniature gamers in creating new paints and combination of colors that we see today. For the record, paints are another thing you can purchase either from your local game shop or your local hobby shop, and I do understand that for some of you, those are both the same shop. I would also point out that the need for some miniature gamers to have the best quality in painted miniatures has led to a thriving industry in folks who paint minis as either a side job or their full-time gig. If you don't believe me, drop that into a Google search and see how many names pop up. Of course, I have to warn you, as with all things, be aware of who you're contracting to do your painting. Some are way better than others, and some are just out for your cash. Then again, when you've got artistic friends, like I do, you've got your hook into getting minis painted. Usually costs me lunch and some paint. To me, that's well worth it. While we're getting into the subject of costs, it's probably occurred to you that miniature wargaming is not an inexpensive hobby. And you would be right. I've seen groups of miniatures, which are up to four, going for upwards of $10 US, and those are unpainted. Other miniatures, which would be more for tabletop role-playing games and less for wargaming, can run you anywhere from $5 to whatever the market will bear. And that last part can be because they're already painted. So if you want to get into miniatures wargaming, you'd better be ready to open up your wallet. After all, once you buy the minis, you still have to paint them. And if you don't have a battlefield to play on already, you're going to want to build one. And as I just said, that ain't going to be cheap either. But once you get through the initial outlay, unless you just happen to catch miniature fever, you should be able to get away with just touching up the paint on your minis and making some terrain repairs from time to time. That being said, you might have to do up some different terrain for other types of battles, but let's not draw this out any longer than we already have. The miniatures themselves can be made of any number of different substances. For me, my first minis were lead-based. Now, for those of you worried about lead poisoning, the lead is typically combined with other metals, so there isn't the danger in using the minis like there would be with lead paint, for example. I still wouldn't lick them, but I'm just saying. Tin miniatures have also made an appearance or two on the market. One of the benefits to making minis out of lead or tin is that you can use a rubber mold. That means they're cheaper to produce. These days, the bulk of the minis on the market are made of either polystyrene or resin, but these have to be made in steel molds, which are, as you may expect, pricier to make. The basic rule of thumb is that if it's a larger company like Games Workshop, you can safely assume the minis are polystyrene or resin made from steel molds. If it's a smaller company, or more to the point, an individual producing minis, they're probably lead or tin and made from the cheaper rubber molds. And yes, you can make them at home yourself if you have the time, the space, and the money for the stuff you'll need. Now, I'm not going to get into all of that on this show, but you can YouTube search it and find videos that will detail the process for you, and most of those videos tell you what they're using and the best places to find it. Okay, there's a couple more things I want to hit on in this section of the tour before we move along. Scaling, other than the size of the minis and terrain, is an absolute in miniature wargaming. What I mean by that is that you scale down the distances for a 28mm rifleman in a historical wargame, that means they should be able to hit a target about 20 feet away. The problem with that is that most gaming tables don't have that kind of space, so the rules in those instances move to what's known as abstract scaling. An example of this comes from the 28mm wargame Bolt Action, which compresses the range of a rifle to 24 inches, the range of a submachine gun to 12 inches, and a pistol's range to 6 inches. Like I've said 100 times on this show, just because it's true in the real world doesn't necessarily mean it's that way in the game world. But so long as everyone understands the rules and the scaling before you start playing, there shouldn't be any issues. The last thing I want to hit on in this section is time. And why do I have that Hootie and the Blowfish song running through my head right now? Anyway, most miniature war games don't have a fixed time scale. In other words, they don't state that X number of seconds equals a round, like the 6-second rounds of D&D. Instead, the rules defer to how far you can move a unit and or what can be done in a single turn. So again, this makes miniature wargaming different from tabletop role-playing games. Okay, so we've looked at some of the history of miniature wargaming. We've looked into some of the how it works of the games. How about we take a look at the company at the top of the mountain of miniature wargaming and the game that's keeping it on the top of that mountain. The company is Games Workshop, and the game is Warhammer 40K. Let's start with Games Workshop. It was founded in 1975 in London, England by John Peake, Ian Livingston, and Steve Jackson. Oh, and for the record, this Steve Jackson isn't the Steve Jackson from Steve Jackson Games. You confused yet? When the company began, they were in offices located at 15 Bolingbroke Road in London, and their original focus was to manufacture wooden boards for games. Some of the games in question were Backgammon, Mancala, and Go. To promote their business, they started a newsletter, Owl and Weasel, in February of 1975. In June of 77, they discontinued Owl and Weasel and replaced it with White Dwarf. From the beginning, there was a bit of difference of philosophy between the three partners in the company. Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson had a very clear intent in progressive games, which would include computer games. John Peake disagreed with this philosophy, as he believed their focus should stay on traditional games, like backgammon. So, as these things tend to go, John Peake left Games Workshop in 1976. When he left, he took the company's main source of income. However, Livingstone and Jackson quickly found a way to replace that income, and that was by getting the official distribution rights to Dungeons & Dragons and other TSR products in the UK. On top of that, they also ran game conventions, and that kept their profile high as well. Needless to say, the company grew, and they opened their first retail shop in April of 1978. In early 1979, Games Workshop funded the creation of Citadel Miniatures, which had offices in Newark-on-Trent. By the way, I'm pointing out these locations for offices for those who are interested in checking out where some of your favorite games and game companies got their start. I realize most of the locales in this week's episode probably mean more to our UK and European listeners, but since I've named a bunch of US-based locales over the past year, I felt it only fair to float our UK fans a favor on this one. Anyway, getting back into the history, Citadel Miniatures was created for the sole purpose of creating the metal miniatures for the various role-playing and tabletop wargames associated with Games Workshop. For the longest time, Citadel Miniatures was actually run separately from Games Workshop, though it was clear who technically owned the company. This separation was continued for several years, but eventually Citadel Miniatures was rolled into the Games Workshop side of the business, and both officially operated under the same umbrella. However, many game fans might not know that for a period of time, Gary Gygax was in serious talks to merge Citadel with TSR. And for a time, Livingstone and Jackson were willing to do it. At some point, though, they decided against it and instead rolled it into their own company and kept control of the product. And for the record, Citadel is still very much a recognized name in the miniature field, and I'll explain why in just a little bit. At the same time this was all going on, the publishing arm of Games Workshop was busy. They released UK reprints of a number of American games, such as Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, Traveller, and Middle-earth role-playing. The reasons for doing the reprints were that, at the time, the cost of importing the American printings of these games wasn't cost-effective, so having the license to do reprints was a much better business decision. For the record, they'd done the same for Dungeons & Dragons since 1977, so it wasn't exactly a new concept for the company. In 1984, Games Workshop chose to stop distributing their products in America through hobby shops and instead opened their own Games Workshop office in the U.S., which led to them opening their own stores in the U.S. shortly thereafter. The Games Workshop brand grew significantly in the late 1980s, totaling more than 250 employees by 1990. Through all of this, there continued to be differences in the vision of the company, especially when Tom Kirby became the general manager in 1986. In 1991, he and Brian Ansell bought out Livingstone & Jackson's shares in Game Workshop for £10 million, and Kirby shifted the focus of Games Workshop to their miniature war games, Warhammer Fantasy Battle and Warhammer 40K, which were their top-selling lines at the time. The change in focus also led to a shift in their market targeting as well, as Games Workshop refocused on a younger, more family-oriented market. This ultimately turned out to be a wise business move for Games Workshop, as they saw increased sales and a more successful company overall, but it came at the expense of some of their older fans who decried the more commercial nature of the company. This led to a couple of employees from Games Workshop leaving the company to publish Fantasy Warlord, which was designed to target the older fans of Games Workshop and therefore compete directly with their former employer. Needless to say, they had extreme difficulty in trying to overthrow Games Workshop, and the company closed its doors in 1993. Around this same time, Games Workshop expanded again, adding more locations in Europe, the US, Canada, and Australia. This expansion came with new branches and a ton of new events organized to promote their various brands. Also during this time, Games Workshop was acquired by the private equity firm ECI Partners, and the company was floated on the London Stock Exchange in October of 1994. In October of 1997, all UK-based operations were relocated to shiny new headquarters, where they're still based in Lenton, Nottingham. Understanding the most basic of business principles, which is diversify or die, they acquired Sabretooth Games, which was a producer of card games, created the Black Library to handle literature, and went into business with THQ to produce computer games based on their products. In late 2009, Games Workshop issued a succession of cease and desist orders against various internet sites it accused of violating their intellectual property rights. Needless to say, that pissed off a chunk of the fan community. On May 16, 2011, Maelstrom Games announced that Games Workshop revised the terms and conditions of their trade agreements with the independent stockists in the UK. Read that to mean independent game stores. The new terms restricted the sale of all Games Workshop products to within the European Economic Area. And since I'm not an economist, I'd suggest you Google that if you want to know and understand more about it. On June 16, 2013, War Games Store, which was a UK-based retailer of Games Workshop products and had been since 2003, announced that Games Workshop had made further changes to the trade agreement with UK-based shops. In 2017, Tom Kirby ended his tenure at the head of Games Workshop when he stepped down. In July of 2021, Games Workshop made changes to their IP guidelines, adopting a zero-tolerance policy towards fan-made games, videos, and animations, and again, the fan base was pissed. It should also be noted that the COVID-19 pandemic hit Games Workshop at least as hard as it did the rest of the world, as the company was forced to halt production for a period of time while the UK worked its way through the quarantine requirements, then through the various steps of reopening that the UK went through as the pandemic proceeded. However, as of this recording, Games Workshop is back to full output and is working to get their supply levels back to pre-COVID levels. Finally, it's been noted by more than one reporter that the presence of Games Workshop in the East Midlands has led to that region becoming the center of the war games industry in Britain, and has led to it being called the Lead Belt, with numerous other companies located there that have been founded by former Games Workshop employees. Now, normally after the history portion of a deep dive, I get into a discussion of the various items produced by a company. In this case, in order to do that, I would have needed to dedicate the entire episode to Games Workshop. And even then, it wouldn't have been enough. Because, yeah, they either produce at present or historically have produced that much stuff. Through their Forge World division, they produce specialist resin minis and conversion kits for all their Games Workshop and Specialist Games titles. I mentioned that Citadel is also a name they still use, and while you'll see the occasional Citadel miniature out there, where most gamers know the name from is the very successful line of acrylic paints it produces for miniatures. They take this very seriously, with about 145 different colors being produced annually and organized into different types intended for different purposes. They also produce a number of other hobby supplies, such as basing materials and modeling tools. If you're interested in seeing all of the Citadel line, you can either head into a Games Workshop store, if there's one in your area, your local game or hobby shop, or check out their website at gamesworkshop.com. And I know I said that at one point they'd ceased doing business with game and hobby shops in the U.S., but over the years they got back into that business, so your local game shop should carry Games Workshop and Citadel products. Just look for the signage for them in the shop, because believe me, you cannot miss it. Okay, with the overall look at Games Workshop behind us, let's dig into their best-selling product, Warhammer 40K. To explain the history of Warhammer 40K, we have to first mention the person responsible for its creation, Rick Priestley. He came to Games Workshop in 1982. More specifically, he was hired onto Citadel Miniatures and was tasked to develop a medieval fantasy miniature war game that would be given away for free to gamers in an attempt to encourage the purchase of more minis. Now, the problem they ran into was D&D didn't, and still doesn't really require the use of miniatures if you want to play the game. And frankly, even if you are going to use minis, you're probably not using more than a dozen or so at a go. Yeah, okay, I know that's not always the case. Shh! So they shifted focus, and in 1983 they created Warhammer Fantasy Battle, which became very successful. WFB was molded in the D&D style, but Priestley had folded in a bit of science fiction by putting advanced technological artifacts like laser weapons into the game. See, Priestley had been working on a spaceship war game since he'd started working for the company, and his goal was to eventually see it get published. He called this game Rogue Trader, and it was a mix of science fiction with classic fantasy elements. This was the basis for what would become Warhammer 40K. Needless to say, he dropped the spaceship combat from the game, understanding that there probably wouldn't be the space either in the book or on a gaming table for it. The original idea was for Games Workshop to sell conversion kits for their WFB miniatures to be adapted for the new game. But they wisely decided later to just create a new line of miniatures for the game. The last adjustment was to the title. Originally, they were going to release the game as Rogue Trader, but shortly before release, Games Workshop signed a contract with 2000 AD to develop a board game based on the comic book Rogue Trooper. Needless to say, they didn't want confusion between the two products, so they changed the name of the new miniatures game to Warhammer 40,000 Rogue Trader and marketed it as a spin-off of WFB, which was true since technically it was. Over the years, the Rogue Trader part of the title was dropped, and while the name is technically Warhammer 40,000, any gamer in the know will call it Warhammer 40K. From 1987 to 2020, 9 different editions of Warhammer 40K have been released, each with their own storylines, miniatures, and paints and terrains developed to help better tell their stories. That doesn't even count the various supplements and expansions that have been released over the years for the various editions. Over time, rules for airplanes, airstrike, and mechanized battles have made their way into the game, and a Warhammer 40K game can literally be whatever those playing the game want it to be. All you have to do is pick the right rule set and supplements, then buy the minis and get to it. Games Workshop has also licensed spin-offs from Warhammer 40K over the year. Some of these are Battlefield Gothic, Inquisitor, and Space Crusade, though there have been several more. There have also been collectible card games, music, comic books, and novels based on the game and its various settings over the years, and pretty much anything with the Warhammer 40K name on it has sold very well. Again, to do the type of deep dive on Warhammer 40K that I would typically do would require an entire episode of its own. And while I might do one of those one of these days, if you're interested, for now, I'm just going to cover a few highlight points. One major difference between Warhammer 40K and traditional wargaming is that Games Workshop doesn't tend to sell ready-to-use minis for their games. Instead, they sell parts, and you have to assemble and paint them before you can use them. And since this is, for most in the hobby, an important part, most gamers don't seem to mind. Also, from a business standpoint, it builds the need for more of the Citadel product line, since paints and cements or glues will be needed for the process. Once you've got them built and painted, you're ready to go. Each mini in Warhammer 40K represents an individual warrior or vehicle, and the rulebooks provide all of the statistics you need to run the game. Officially, it should be noted that Warhammer 40K does not have a scale, but unofficially, the minis are an approximate 1/60th ratio. Much like other war games, the ratios aren't the same for firearms, since a bolt gun has a range of 24 inches, which would be 120 feet at 1/60th scale. So, like I said earlier, don't try to apply real-world numbers to a miniature war game. There's a plethora of more rules and concepts about Warhammer 40K, and I'll save them for a potential Warhammer 40K show in the future. If you're interested in hearing that show, hit me up on social or drop an email and we'll make it happen. Until then, we've come to the end of today's tour. Next week, we begin the second year of our podcast with a very different type of show for us. I'm going to combine my day job with my hobby and second love and discuss the role that role-playing games have in addressing mental health issues. I can assure you, this is a show you are not going to want to miss. Well, we did it. We officially made it an entire year with our podcast. I have to take a minute to thank you from the bottom of my heart for all of your support over the past year. We've gone from a handful of listeners for those early podcasts to dozens of regular listeners. And while I know that's not as impressive as some shows, for me, it shows the progress of patience. And I'm forever grateful to all of you who've taken the trip with me so far. And, for the record, I intend to keep making this show for as long as you will keep listening to it. We've got more revisits I want to do, plus a notepad full of original ideas for shows that I've been keeping as we go along. I want to send a very special shout-out to the folks on social media who've been following us since the first time I sent out a tweet with the @RolePlayingP tag. You folks have given me suggestions I use to this day, and you've inspired me to develop new ideas both for this show and the campaign build-along. What's year two have in store for us? You're just going to have to stick around and find out. All right, so enough of the sappy shit. As they say in the wrestling business, let's go home. The music we use on this show comes from Pixabay.com. Check them out for your royalty-free, license-free music needs for your product. Role-Playing History is a production of Bad GM Productions. Check us out on Facebook, Bad GM Productions, Twitter, @BadGMP, YouTube, Bad GM Productions, Twitch, Bad GM, and you can email us, badgmproductions@gmail.com. All right, so next week we kick off year two with a look at mental health and role-playing games. And yes, the two really do work well together. Trust me on this. But that's next week. Until then, I'm Wayne Davis, and you're role-playing history.